If this is Tuesday, the fate of this economy again hangs on you, the humble American consumer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is, in fact, Tuesday, the 17th of November. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. One of the things we do on this program, so that you don't have to, is keep an eye on the incremental changes in this economy. And then, once a trend reveals itself, put that into big picture context. Thus, Mitchell Hartman starts us off today with this morning's report on retail sales, up just a touch, 0.3% last month, less than expected, and way less than September. Seeing as how the consumer goes is how this economy goes, here's Mitchell with that promised big picture context.
If you have anything to do with the retail business, something you don't want to see is this kind of fall off in sales growth in the fall.
October's report is actually a bad omen for the holiday season.
Retail analyst Camilla Yanishevsky at CFRA Research predicts this will be the first year since 2008 that annual holiday sales don't go up. John Lear at Morning Consult says lack of new fiscal stimulus from Congress is dampening consumers' appetite to spend. So is the pandemic.
When you see the number of new cases spiking as it is currently, we see consumer confidence in the U.S. decrease.
This is not an equal opportunity retail slowdown, though, says analyst Nick Shields at Third Bridge.
Main Street retail is weaker than big box retail.
He says smaller retailers have a harder time dealing with COVID restrictions and transitioning to online shopping. Shields says if more of them shut down, it'll hurt the entire economy. Big brands will have fewer consumer outlets, and commercial landlords will take a hit.
They do serve a lot of massive retailers like the department stores, like Walmart, like Target. But they also have small business and medium-sized retailers.
Shields says we probably won't know until early next year, after the holiday shopping results are in, how many smaller retailers are going to throw in the towel and shut down for good. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As we get to the waning days of this year, businesses are starting to figure out their taxes, how much they made, how much they spent, and how much they're going to owe. This year, though, there is a wrinkle in that process for businesses that got Paycheck Protection Program loans. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
A few weeks ago, Randy George got an email about his restaurant, the Red Hen Bakery and Cafe in Middlesex, Vermont, from a business advocacy group.
Notes on tax planning. It is important to have a plan for your 2020 income taxes.
The email was a warning for businesses that received Paycheck Protection Program loans or other pandemic relief.
For many of you, that will create a 2020 income tax liability that will need to be paid early in 2021.
George says a tax liability early next year would be painful. It's getting colder and business is already slowing down. Virus cases are rising. George says the PPP loan got the restaurant through the spring and summer, but the threat of a big tax bill?
It makes you wonder if it's going to come back around to bite us.
Under current rules, businesses whose PPP loans are forgiven are not allowed to claim deductions on the expenses the loan money paid for. Payroll, utilities, rent. Matt Hedrick runs the accounting firm Harmony Group in Maryland. He says fewer deductions mean business owners will end up owing taxes on more income.
The indirect situation here, it can be one for a number of businesses where you're going to end up paying taxes on that money, even though that's not necessarily what was intended.
Hedrick says he's advising his clients to hold off on applying for forgiveness. Thinking is maybe the rules might change to allow expenses to be deductible.
You certainly want to be careful about making any decisions that then lead you to, you know, pay tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes right as you're coming out, hopefully, if we're lucky, of another wave of coronavirus.
The bottom line is small businesses are facing a ton of uncertainty about the taxes they may owe on their PPP loans. Hedrick says he's still not sure when a business should say the loan was forgiven.
Is it something that you would recognize in 2021's tax year? Would it happen in 2020? What's the interplay between those two things?
All of that means small business owners are preparing for uncertain tax bills. Jackie London is a public health consultant based in Colorado who got a PPP loan.
You know, when I get a payment from a client, I just kind of automatically deduct a third of it to put into a tax account and just try and pretend that that money's not even there.
London says it's not easy to set aside cash that she could otherwise spend today.
I was just looking at whether I can let up a little bit on those estimates. And I think just on the edge of caution, I'm going to keep estimating it the way that I have been.
That way, she'll be able to cover a bigger than expected tax bill if she gets one next year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street this Tuesday in mid-November, more down than up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Elections, the saying goes, have consequences, even if those consequences take years to play out. Right at the very beginning of his term, President Trump pulled the United States out of a big multilateral trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a dozen or so Pacific Rim countries aligning themselves to deal with growing Chinese influence in the region. Now, almost 4 years later, come the consequences. China and 14 other Asian Pacific countries, Korea and Japan, among them, have signed a trade deal that covers a third of the global economy. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on what it's going to mean for the United States.
Long story short, a group of Asia-Pacific countries came together, opened their markets to one another, and the U.S. is on the outside looking in.
I think it's a wake-up call for the United States.
Wendy Cutler is vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, is, as trade deals go, modest. But it further connects powerful economies like Japan, Korea, and Australia to China. And that's actually huge, says Jennifer Hillman, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
It is China getting solidified as the center of Asian trade and investment, with more goods, services, and investment than ever flowing through China. And I think the United States is going to have to respond to it.
The U.S. has responded to Chinese influence over trading partners before. The Obama administration negotiated and signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was a comprehensive trade deal with Asian countries that left China out. Trump torched that deal. Francesco Sisci is a researcher at the People's University of China.
These countries were left out in the cold, and now they're moving towards a lesser agreement with China.
Chad Baun, senior fellow with the Peterson Institute, says every time a major trade agreement leaves out the U.S., U.S. businesses pay a price.
Japan signed a free trade agreement with the European Union. The European Union did one with Canada. The United States has been falling behind, and this is just the latest example.
He would advise the Biden administration to revive, modify, and rebrand the TPP, a tall order given everything else on the to-do list. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
One might think that Taylor Swift, megastar, pop icon, pick your superlative, has it all. And in a way, she does. What she does not have, though, is ownership of the master rights to her first six albums. It's kind of a long story. It goes back to a deal she signed back when she wasn't Taylor Swift, Taylor Swift. So I'm just going to cut to the news. Those rights, again, rights that Swift does not own, have been sold to a private equity firm for $300 million. Swift, obviously not happy about that, is firing back by re-recording the music so she can license her own versions. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has today's music industry primer.
Before, there was old Taylor. Now, there's new Taylor. But I knew you, dancing in your Levi's. Forget the difference of style or lyrics. New Taylor's voice is 14 years older. Cristelia Garcia teaches intellectual property law at the University of Colorado.
Of course, she can re-sing the songs, but they won't be the same.
Fans would have to choose these new recordings over the old ones for them to have value.
She may come up with something creative enough to do in her re-recordings of these.
But it's not all about popularity and plays. It's also about the massively profitable business of licensing for commercials and movies, says Tanya Butler at Berklee College of Music.
Forget whether it's called a master or a sound recording or a musical work. It's an asset. Most artists don't own their music. The record labels do. They get ownership of the masters because they pay for the recordings. That's how it goes in the music business. And Butler doesn't think Swift's move will change how labels work with new talent, who are desperate to get signed.
They can say, well, there's 10,000 artists behind you who are willing to take this deal. Goodbye.
Power moves are reserved for powerful artists. Prince spent much of his career fighting Warner Brothers for his masters, and he eventually got them back, but only after agreeing to make two more albums for the label. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Being a member of the royal family is not just a job, it's a life.
A life for which one must dress appropriately. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 167 points today. 0.5% closed at 29,783. The NASDAQ down 24 points, about 0.2%, 11,899. The S&P 500 shed 17 points, almost 0.5%. 3609. As we heard from Mitchell, the Commerce Department released disappointing retail sales figures today, rose at their slowest pace in 6 months. Those figures did. Kroger gave back 1.2%. Lowe's dipped about 1.2% as well. Amazon has launched the new pharmacy business with medications delivered free to its Prime members. The online retailer picked up 0.1%. A lot of traditional pharmacy stocks thus dipped. Walgreens Boots Alliance kicked it down. Oh, that's pretty good. Kicked down Walgreens Boots? Come on. Anyway, down 9.6% the day you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is an item from Associated General Contractors. That is the contractor's big trade group. It says more construction projects were canceled than were started in the past 12 months, and that construction employment declined in most metropolitan areas. Houston and its surroundings lost more construction jobs than any other big city over those 12 months. So we asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to check in with some people down there to get a sense of things.
Before COVID hit and the economy tanked, Houston Methodist Hospital was well along in its plans to expand downtown. Centennial Tower is a more than $700 million project to serve more patients.
The day that I had to call the architects and the engineers and the general contractor back in March and tell them we were going to put this on hold, that was a hard call.
Sid Sanders is Senior Vice President for Design, Construction, and Real Estate at Houston Methodist. He says the tower was put on hold because the economy is just too unpredictable right now.
Centennial is over 1 million square feet. It's going to be somewhere around 30 floors. It will probably peak out with close to 1,000 people on that job site during the peak of construction.
Sanders says he's hoping to get started on building the Centennial Tower in the first part of 2022, about a year later than first planned. Richard Branch, chief economist for Dodge Data and Analytics, says total construction spending in Houston in the first 9 months of 2020 was about $15 billion.
It sounds like a lot of money. However, that's a full 17% below where Houston was during the same period of 2019.
One of the reasons Houston is a little worse off than the U.S. as a whole is because of the slowdown in the energy sector. Patrick Jankowski is Senior Vice President of Research at the Greater Houston Partnership. He says COVID is making chemical plants and refineries along the Houston Ship Channel hit pause.
We're seeing a lot of those projects put on hold now as the industry is trying to assess where are we going with energy demand and where are we going with demand for chemicals and plastics.
He says the demand for construction workers is down too.
In February, just before the pandemic hit, we had 244,000 people working in the construction industry in Houston. The pandemic cost us 31,000 of those jobs. We've only gotten back about 3,000. We've gotten back, so less than 10% of what we lost.
Stan Merrick says his Houston workforce is down 20% from last year. He's CEO of Merrick Brothers, one of the largest commercial interior contractors in Texas. He was set to bid on the Centennial Tower project at Houston Methodist when the project got delayed.
Now, as far as the workload, yes, there have definitely been jobs stopped. But you know, there's work.
Merrick says there's still some work because of the contract secured before COVID. But he's not expecting things to get much better until 2022. I'm Andy Euler, Marketplace.
The inspiration for a new business strikes when inspiration strikes. Sometimes that's during the pandemic, and sometimes it's because of it.
My name is Nia Grigsby. I am the founder and owner of the Schoolbox Toolbox. I have been an educator for 20 years, 17 years in Maryland, and I now live in Georgia and have been teaching fourth and fifth grade. I'm definitely an old dog learning a lot of new tricks. And this virtual environment is something that not only have we had to adapt to as teachers, but the kids are having to adapt to it as well. And so I'm watching my daughters adapt to this virtual environment. And for my girls, it works, but it doesn't work for everyone. And some of the discrepancies in, you know, where people live, how people live, those things are really coming out now. I have kids that are at daycare who are on like really, shoddy Wi-Fi. And so they're getting kicked off of the Zoom meetings all day long. They're spending their days in the waiting room, just, you know, letting them back in constantly. So when we got out of school in March, I was at home teaching and trying to support my two daughters in school at the same time. But, you know, we quickly ran out of things. The children eat the pencils. They eat them. They just disappear. And I remember thinking, man, you know, I need to get some school supplies. But at that time, people weren't going back and forth to the stores. And I couldn't go back to my classroom to get things because the school was closed. And then it occurred to me that I could just make the box of supplies myself. And that's actually how Schoolbox Toolbox was born. So a lot of the supplies I actually have already, I pre-ordered them in bulk, so to match the boxes. However, you are able to build your own box. You can build a custom box, and then I will either order it or I will go to the store and buy it. So, you know, I have been shipping boxes all over the country, and it was really exciting starting out. And I knew there would be a lag when school got started. So, you know, things have slowed down quite a bit. But right now it is helping to, you know, support my family, me and my children. And I've also received some emails from other like tutoring companies that want to partner up and do things like send supplies to the kids that are at home. So I see potential for this to grow and become, you know, much bigger than, you know, I thought it would be starting out.
That's Nia Grigsby making boxes of school supplies in Georgia and shipping them out. Tell us about your economy, would you? Online at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Season 4 of The Crown dropped on Netflix over the weekend. The trials and tribulations of the British royal family, somewhat fictionalized. We are up to the Princess Diana era in this season, which of course means royal fashion. And that in turn means that we turn to Elizabeth Holmes, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, now of her Instagram feed and a thing she does there called So Many Thoughts, offering so many thoughts on what mostly Catherine and Meghan, the Duchesses of Cambridge and Sussex, are wearing and why. Her new book out today is called HRH, So Many Thoughts on Royal Style. Hey, Elizabeth, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Kai.
So let's get right to it, because there's so much I want to talk to you about this book. And we're going to go to page 3 of the introduction. Not that I expect you to have it memorized, but you write, royal fashion is singular in its purpose and its power. Explain.
Yeah, so I think what has drawn me to royal fashion for more than a decade now is how these women use their clothing. And I think you have to sort of understand the duties that they have. A big part of their job is to appear in public. And it gets a tremendous amount of attention. You know, when Kate or Meghan steps out these days, all the women's magazine mm-hmm. sites write about it. And that attention is something that the royal family recognizes and they use to their advantage. They pick their clothing, their colors, their silhouettes, their brands very carefully. And it helps build this public image and this brand and this affection for a centuries-old institution.
What happens, I don't even know if I'm asking a reasonable question, but what happens when they get royal fashion wrong, if that makes any sense?
I think it's a very reasonable question. You know, we will never know what the royal family is trying to say with their clothes for certain, right? Because their whole mantra is never complain, never explain. And so we are left to kind of connect the dots and do the sleuthing. And so often that message that they're sending is one that makes a lot of sense and is really exciting and supports whatever cause they're championing. But then often you see these missteps. You know, you see Kate step out in Dolce & Gabbana after that brand has been embroiled in so many controversies. And you think, what's happening there? You know, did someone on your team not Google? And so I think it's important to understand this is not a selective game that they play. You know, being a member of the royal family is not just a job, it's a life. And every time they step out in public, they are held to account. And the bar is actually pretty low, right? Just don't wear things that are offensive. It doesn't always have to be like steeped with meaning. And so, yeah, I think it's important to point out both their wins and their missteps.
Give me an example, would you, of how they are trying to say something without actually saying anything?
Yeah. So earlier this year, Kate and William went on a short royal tour to Ireland. And the first day she showed up in green, which expected, right? You're visiting Ireland.
Yeah, it's almost the next too easy, right?
Come on. Yeah, exactly. The next day she wore a cream coat, which was actually a throwback. It was something that royal fashion lovers saw when she was dating William. So she pulled it out of her closet, a repeat. And then the third day she wore an orange sweater. And none of those outfits were particularly exciting on their own. But you step back and the green, the white, and the orange, it formed the colors of the Irish flag. When she does something like that and you recognize that people are going to run montages of her visit there, they run, you know, royal tour recaps, and you see that and you just think, gosh, somebody is really thinking about this. You know, you're playing a long game here and you're understanding that how you present yourself and the resulting coverage is just so important, and clothes are a critical part of that.
Not to get too far into the political, but actually I did want to touch on something. And it's not Melania Trump. She certainly said things with her clothing. And then Kamala Harris the other night with the white suit, which you commented on, certainly is saying something with that. But a couple of weeks before the election, Dr. Jill Biden wore a Dolce & Gabbana outfit. It was that flower print dress, and she had a flower print mask too, which was a little matchy-matchy for me. But it clearly... nobody was paying attention to Dolce & Gabbana's history inside Dr. Biden's camp. And that surprised you. And since it surprised you, it surprised me.
Yeah, it really did surprise me because, you know, people slide into my DMs and say, well, doesn't she have so much more to think about?
Yeah.
Well, yes, maybe. But her team does not. This is their job. You know, I mean, these women on the public stage are not operating by themselves. And listen, Dr. Biden's look, I believe it was at the last debate, it was so striking. She was wearing a bright floral dress, trying to cheer everybody up at a very difficult and stressful time. The matching mask hammered home the importance of mask wearing and, you know, a belief in science. Like, there was some real effort put in there. And it sort of made me a little bit sad that somebody didn't take a minute to just Google the designer and figure out, you know, like what the conversation around that brand has been online and their comments. And I do hope that, you know, as she prepares to go into the White House again, there are some people who are helping her.
I was right, though. The mask was too matchy-matchy, right?
Everyone's a critic, Kai.
Oh, man. Elizabeth Holmes, her new book, born out of her Instagram, which is called So Many Thoughts. The book is called HRH, So Many Thoughts on Royal Style. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I'm going to die on that hill. Matchy matchy is no good. We've got an excerpt from Elizabeth's book online. It's about how Meghan Markle's humanitarian work matches up with some of the brands that she wears. It's at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today brought to you by Pro Football and this pandemic. Maybe you missed it. I sure did. But the NFL announced last month there is not going to be a Pro Bowl this season. That's the National Football League's All-Star Game, which is fine. Makes sense. Not smart to have an extra game when the virus is raging. Set aside the regular season here for just a second. Instead, though, the league announced today players selected for the Pro Bowl are going to face off against each other electronically in Madden NFL 21, the video game from Electronic Arts. I don't know. All right, we're going, but not before you get your Tuesday moment of economic context. It is courtesy of the New York Federal Reserve. In a report out today, The New York Fed said American consumers started borrowing again in the third quarter of the year, July through September, after cutting back in Q2. Credit card debt was down in the third quarter. We did borrow more, though, to buy cars and houses. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.